Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Wednesday, October 1st, and day one of a federal government shutdown. How long will it last? Essential services will continue, but you can probably expect some disruption if you need to deal with some federal offices. We'll get the latest from Congressman Ed Case. We talk about the reality of rooftop solar installations with the end of the year deadline looming for federal tax credits. We hear from an award-winning essayist who focuses on disasters and the bonds formed during our toughest times. And we meet a honey creeper native to Kauai on this week's Manu Minute. Plus, we learn about a new fisheries program. It comes at a time when the industry is rethinking what sustainable fishing means amid shifting regulations in the Pacific. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, we woke up to the latest eruption at Kilauea Volcano and day one of a federal government shutdown. Fountaining soared to more than 300 feet overnight and amid uncertainty about what services would be available at the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. The National Park Service website indicates the area is open for now. And this morning, Senators Brian Schatz and Mazie Hirono are in our nation's capital dealing with the political drama of the shutdown. Here's Schatz speaking on the Senate floor yesterday afternoon.
This president believes that he's a monarch. This president finds the legislative branch to be a nuisance. And you know what? The legislative branch is a nuisance. That's the architecture of the Constitution of the United States. We're supposed to be in a struggle with each other. We're supposed to argue and fight. And then we're supposed to come to an accommodation. But we can't come to an accommodation until there's a meeting. And so we're going to be here fighting for health care. And we're also going to be here fighting to reopen the government. If the clock strikes midnight and we're not able to avert this shutdown, then we are going to be here ready to deal.
Our congressional delegation has sent out statements denouncing the shutdown. Representative Jill Takuda is en route home to the islands, and we were able to connect with U.S. Representative Ed Case this morning.
First of all, this is just a deeply disappointing, if not disgusting, shutdown. It was completely avoidable, and a bipartisan solution to finishing it as soon as possible is completely doable. And so it's extremely frustrating that it happened. And it's frustrating that we're not cracking through on a very obvious set of possibilities to end the shutdown as soon as it begins. This shutdown is occurring because the president and his majority colleagues in Congress, and they are in control of Congress. So this is the president and the Congress acting. They do not want to face and extend an existing law which provides really critical health care benefits to tens of millions of Americans, including tens of thousands of people throughout Hawaii who are reliant upon this law to be able to afford their basic premiums for health care and thus to afford health care itself. Those premiums would increase by over 100%, really by the end of this year, if we don't extend this law. And so fundamentally, they don't want to do that. And thus the shutdown. And that's highly unfortunate because there are definitely solutions to this. Congress requires a bipartisan compromise vote on this because 60 votes are needed in the United States Senate. So unless Democrats are just going to outright agree to the president's avoidance of this issue, which they've voted several times now not to do, we're going to have to come up with a bipartisan compromise solution to get this done. And that's very, very doable. And that's where my efforts have been focused over the last several days, is to try to fashion that bipartisan solution. It's eminently doable. All of that said, I can express all that frustration and all of that disappointment and disgust, but we're dealing with a shutdown right now. And so we are in a very difficult situation of great uncertainty, of chaos and disruption, further chaos and disruption across the federal government. And the folks that are on the front lines of that are feeling it the most directly are, of course, our federal workers. We have somewhere in the range of 25,000 federal civilian employees in Hawaii. We also, of course, have almost 50,000 active U.S. military and their spouses and the contractors that are private contractors that are dependent upon the military and funding. And so they are acutely affected by a shutdown. Our federal workers were either furloughed today outright without pay, or if they're essential workers such as law enforcement, air traffic controllers, et cetera, certainly U.S. military, then they're working without pay, and that's fundamentally unfair. So the bottom line here is that the effects of a shutdown at any time are far-reaching and severe, and thus a shutdown is to be avoided at all costs.
Well, the concern, too, is how long is this going to be? Because there have been very short shutdowns, and there have been very long ones, and the longest one, I believe, was in Trump's first term.
That's exactly right. There have been times when a shutdown has lasted 1 or 2 days. Everybody got up to the actual deadline of midnight when a federal funding bill expired without passing a new federal funding bill and came to their senses when they woke up in the morning. Unfortunately, Washington woke up this morning and didn't come to its senses. The longest one was over a month back in 2018, 2019, as I came back to Congress. That's what I was welcomed with, was a federal government shutdown that was destructive, disruptive, finally ended. And the answer is, I have no idea. It certainly seems from the statements and actions of the Trump administration that they intend to drag this out, at least unless there is unconditional surrender to their demands and to their avoidance of the consequences of health care, to legitimate concerns about, you know, DOGE reductions, rescissions, impoundments, curtailment of federal spending without congressional authority. These are the issues that are on the table, but they seem to have a my way or the highway approach, going so far as in the last couple of days to President Trump threatening that if a shutdown occurred, he would not just furlough federal workers, he would outright fire them, which I think is absolutely irresponsible. First of all, I don't believe he has a legal authority to do that. And second, it's pure intimidation and pure fear-mongering. He went a step further yesterday and hinted around reducing actual benefits to Americans if the shutdown continued. And that's absolutely irresponsible. Those benefits, like Social Security, should absolutely continue. They've always continued in past shutdowns. They are created by law. It would be, in my view, illegal to discontinue them. President doesn't get to discontinue fundamental benefits at his or her whim. And so, you know, this will kind of indicate the mindset that is being portrayed in Washington by the administration, and it doesn't harbor well for a quick resolution, even though a quick resolution could be reached literally inside a few days.
Well, we know that, you know, our delegation is working hard, Senator Schatz and Senator Mazie Hirono there in Washington, as they try and hammer something out. And hopefully they can, the cooler heads will prevail and we can get back to the table here, you know, because right now it's a little bit hazy, right? What's affected? Everything from the Park Service, you know, we understand that folks are trying to keep places like the Arizona Memorial and the Bofin Museum going. But, you know, lots of questions about possible delays at the airport with travel and with our federal courts and some of the basic, you know, services. Folks are wondering, oh, gosh, is the VA open today? If you have business to do, you have also put out something which you hope is helpful for people as they try and navigate during this time.
Yes. If people will go to my website at case.house.gov, case.house.gov, on the very first opening page, there will be, among one of the rotating images, a link to a summary that I put out last night as the shutdown happened of what exactly is happening, why it is happening, how it is affecting folks. And I've tried there to answer some very, very basic questions that people have. For example, will I continue to get my Social Security benefits? The answer is, and absolutely should be, yes. Will I continue to be able to get VA benefits and to access the VA healthcare facilities? The answer to that is yes. Will I be able to continue to travel through the airport? The answer is yes. you know, there's a lot of misinformation that goes out. And frankly, it is very deliberate misinformation on some occasions from this administration, which I think is irresponsible in and of itself. Now, there's stuff that we don't know, because not only do we have a confusing and chaotic situation, but it is being administered in the middle of a shutdown by an administration that is confusing and chaotic to start with. And so it's hard to predict exactly what where they may differ from some very longstanding assumptions about what does and doesn't get affected during a shutdown. Some things are definitely affected. I think parts of government that are not considered essential will essentially be shut down. I outlined some of those in the material that is on my website. You spoke about the USS Arizona and our Pearl Harbor memorials. I actually spent the better part of the morning on that particular issue. And it appears that we've got an understanding between the National Park Service and the Pacific Historic Parks, which is our great nonprofit partner there that actually runs the visitor center, the USS Missouri, the Pacific Aviation Museum, Bofin Museum, and gets people out to and from the Arizona Memorial. It sounds like as long as they can sign something in Washington today, that will all stay open, because basically the nonprofit will make sure that that happens, utilizing its own funding. And so that's good news. But our national parks will be severely curtailed in terms of access and services. And there's a whole range of other areas. And over time, if we don't get this fixed fast, the strain on just the delivery of the federal services, even if essential, like Social Security, like VA, will start to be felt in just delayed responses or non-responsiveness from those offices themselves, as those federal workers just get burned out. And again, let's remember that they're working without pay, subject to reimbursement, but they're working without pay. That's not a very good working condition. So some of the things I think we can predict pretty well, but a lot of it we can't.
Yes, well, we have been through this before. We hope that this will not be as long as the last one, and certainly not longer, as we try and navigate through the healthcare funding and all. But we certainly appreciate your time this morning.
Okay, thanks so much.
That was U.S. Representative Ed Case talking about the government shutdown. Look for links to learn more on our website later today. You are back with the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. You know, we've been hearing for months now about how the federal tax credits for rooftop solar will go away at the end of the year. So if you have not yet committed to green energy, is it too late to get a system before the price tag jumps in 2026? Here to answer that question is HVR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Well, I have a system already in place, but yeah, I worry about others who don't.
Yeah, so on paper, in order to get this tax credit, which is 30% off a system, so it is a big deal, you have 3 months. But in reality, you're probably out of time. And the reason for that is because the tax credit, in order to be eligible for it, your system has to be fully installed as well as able to provide power to the utility. And according to the different solar companies that I've called up in the last couple of weeks, that process to get a new system up and running takes anywhere from 2 to 4 months on the neighbor islands and 4 to 6 months on Oahu. So Rocky Mold heads the Hawaii Solar Energy Association, and he told me that depending on where you live, you might have missed your window.
The clock is ticking. And in some cases, it's prudent to warn customers that, hey, if you're counting on the tax credit and being installed in time, at a certain point, you know, that's going to be at risk, right? And the question is whether you're going to want to go ahead and go forward without that certainty. You know, even now, there are no guarantees you're going to get that tax credit.
And let's say you do want to chance it. You say, I've been thinking about solar and I really want to try to access this credit. When you look at the market as a whole, they are really clogged up right now, because what happened was President Donald Trump signed into law the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, and that moved up the tax credit deadline from December 31st of this year from 2032. So all of a sudden, instead of having 6 years, now people only had 6 months. And so the solar industry just got this rush of calls for new solar systems, of people trying to get in line to get in on that tax credit. Hawaiian Electric saw twice as many applications for new solar systems in July compared to June. KIUC also saw an uptick in July, and by August, they were receiving 3 times as many applications as they had seen in June. And so because of this high demand, many of the solar companies that I have talked to have said that they are already at capacity for this year. They're not taking new clients. One of those companies, Rising Sun Solar, operates all across the islands, Kauai, Oahu, Maui, and Hawaii Island. And Matias Bisasso is their CEO. And he says that demand has just been exponential for his company since midsummer. And that's especially hard for his business on Maui.
We were heavily impacted by the fires. We lost a lot of projects and we had to downsize. Just for measure, today we are about the quarter of the size that we were 2 years ago. And demand is as high, if not higher, than it was at other times.
And is there anything that can be done to speed up this process? I mean, I know there's issues with permitting too.
Yeah, absolutely. So capacity is one issue internally, and companies are trying to negotiate that as it depends on their business. But they say that there are some things that bog down this process that are just out of their control. Utilities have to approve applications for new systems. So HECO has said it's working to make sure that that process is efficient. They said they'll put more staff on it if they need to contend with those applications. And then, as you mentioned, permitting. This has been a pervasive challenge across a ton of industries, not just solar. Matias Bisasso interestingly said that that process is working better on the neighbor islands than it has in years past. But there was a bit of an awkward moment with Honolulu's Department of Planning and Permitting recently, right? Because we had this huge federal policy bill that moved the tax credit deadline up, and that went into effect on July 4th. And then 1 month later, exactly 1 month later, on August 4th, the planning department rolled out an entirely new permitting system called H&L Build. And there were concerns from the solar industry, as well as the Honolulu City Council, that permits were not moving through the pipeline as quickly as they had prior to the new system. And Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi, who has made permitting one of his key issues, accelerating this process, went before the City Council last week and basically said that he didn't think his administration and the department were being given a fair shake when you consider how massive an undertaking it is to transition Honolulu's 2.5-decade-old permitting system. POSSE, the permitting system, was put in place in 1998 to a new platform. But in those comments, he did acknowledge that the deadline that the solar industry is facing is really frustrating.
We've been totally transparent with that industry, recognizing that they represent about 60% of the permit applications. We know how vital it is. We understand also that the federal legislation has put a time clock on them that's caused a lot of anxiety. It's just unfortunate that we're going through this incredible integration after years at the same time. We couldn't have predicted either one of those. So we're sensitive to that, and we're doing everything we can to make sure that they can get their business handled.
So the Department of Planning and Permitting Director, Donna Puna, was there that day to present to the City Council kind of the growing pains that they're dealing with and how they're contending with this. And I pulled her aside after, and I asked what the department was doing specifically for solar, and she said they were very empathetic to what solar companies on Oahu need to get done. And so one of the challenges was typically residential solar permits go through an expedited review, but Apuna said some of the permits were getting flat and then redirecting to like GenPop, to the regular, very slow permitting process. So they've put staff on trying to shepherd those permits through more quickly. And they have also created a landing page on H&L Build's website specifically for solar companies and the information that they need to get solar permits through.
Yeah, and you know, I know that it was just a real problem before they decided to switch to the system. You know, you were hearing the solar companies just like, oh, this is killing us, right? There were issues with townhomes, I think, and the slow processing. But yeah, this is like a double whammy.
And this is not unique to Oahu. So for instance, solar companies that I talked to on Hawaii Island mentioned permitting. The current mayor made that one of his platforms to run on when he won election this last year as well. Kauai is interesting because they have kind of two pathways for solar permits. So if you want something that's less than, I believe, 10 kilowatts, you get an almost instantaneous approval for your permit. But anything bigger than that, which is what most homeowners want, especially if you have storage, has to go through a slower process. So that's something that folks have said is bogging that down Kauai's process for bringing new solar online as well. So it's kind of the forever challenge that people are working on. And it's something that a lot of folks have been pointing to in this time now is, in the mayor's words, particularly unfortunate.
Yeah, and you know, like when these credits go away, then the price tag just jumps, and you know, it's a big gulp to swallow, right? I mean, it's expensive.
Right. So in Rocky Mold's words, it's going to be negative for customers to have to contend with a higher cost of solar. And the industry itself is expecting a bit of a chill, right? Because now the price tag is less attractive to folks who are looking for rooftop solar systems for their homes. So depending on your business model, some companies I talked to are refocusing in on the commercial market. They have tax credits that have longer runways, so there's more time to get federal subsidies for those types of programs. Others said that they're going to try to absorb some of the costs of solar to keep the price appealing to customers, but some companies said that they didn't have the luxury to do that. And some want state-level incentives. For instance, there's a state tax credit that you can apply to solar to be revisited, either to be more targeted towards lower-income customers or to be higher, to have a higher cap overall. But by and large, the companies that I spoke with said the thing that makes solar work, the thing that makes the messaging for solar work in Hawaii is our energy costs are already so high that for many people, they suspect solar is still going to be a good deal in 2026 and beyond.
Yeah, let's hope they can afford it, right?
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking to HFAIR's climate and energy reporter, Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. One of the most prolific essayists in America today was recently in town for a talk at the University of Hawaii. Rebecca Solnit is known for her work on feminism and her critiques of capitalism. More recently, she's turned her attention toward climate issues. She's most recently the author of A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. Solnit stopped by our studio to talk with the conversation's D.W. Gibson. She starts by describing how the communities that form around disasters affect the way we interact with each other as individuals.
There's a lot of bad Hollywood movies, a lot of media people, a lot of authorities whose assumptions about human nature is that we're basically weak and selfish, and that in the absence of institutional authority backed by violence, we'll be panicky, hapless, chaotic, make bad decisions, stampede, or we'll be thieves, rapists, pillagers, etc.
The worst of the worst.
Yep, yep. And it's like, well, maybe that's who you are. But most people are actually amazing in disasters. And I know with the Maui fires, you saw extraordinary solidarity, generosity, and bravery in the moment, and some extraordinary community organizing, sort of mutual aid in the aftermath. And that's really normal. That's who people mostly are in disasters. And racism and fear-mongering can corrupt that. Also, a lot of elites prize private property and the status quo more than the survival of the vulnerable, as we saw 20 years ago with Hurricane Katrina. But again, most people are amazing. And I found that such a profound truth. Not only do people rise to the occasion, but often in finding meaning, purpose, immediacy, connection, a sense of belonging, they find things missing in everyday life, which is another kind of disaster of alienation and disconnection. And it suggested to me that the things we want most are meaning, connection, purpose, a sense of belonging to the larger whole, to civil society, the larger community, not just to your private people. And so disasters tell us a lot about who we are. And in the age of climate chaos, we need to know who we are in an emergency and what we most deeply want, because I think it really is different than what is marketed to us by people who want us to be selfish, greedy consumers.
I think sort of disasters, as you described there, really break down horizontals in our life, right? And we think a lot in horizontals in terms of left and right and less about sort of the structures and people who emphasize things like property and ownership and things like that. And perhaps in the landscape of disaster, there's opportunities to have more horizontal connection.
Yeah, what you have in common becomes really important. And I talk to people who evacuated the World Trade Towers when the planes crashed into them. It was a deeply anti-capitalist moment. Nobody was competing, shoving. Everybody helped everybody else. A quadriplegic accountant was carried down 57 floors by his coworkers. And those differences don't matter so much. Something I always know about rural life, where disaster in some sense is this powerful weather is not that far away, is that whatever your left politics, your Pentecostal neighbor has the snowplow attachment to his F-150, maybe not so relevant here, but the equivalent. And so you have a relationship with him. I think it's an interesting moment where divisiveness is so serving some part of our politics. What is it that we have in common is something I see a lot of people trying to figure out, to bridge some of those gaps, not to sell out or to, you know, I don't believe in finding common ground with Nazis until they stop being Nazis, something I wrote about a few years ago. But I do believe that there are a lot of people, once the categories, you know, become less important, we might connect to.
Plenty of non-Nazis walking around. That's very
helpful. Yeah, yeah.
It also makes me think about the writing you've done about how we think and the way we think either hinders or liberates us. What sort of stories do you think limit us? And what sort of stories do you want to tell in moments like this one that we're in?
Well, at the university, I'm talking about the way change really works, the power of memory. Hope, people think, is about the future, but I think hope really comes from knowing the past. If you have a strong grounding in how we got to where we are, all the victories won so that women got the vote, got reproductive rights, okay, lost reproductive rights in some states, but if you know how change works, you know it will continue to work and that we can participate in it. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of disempowerment that comes from stories that the world only gets changed by a powerful minority. In fact, ordinary people together are quite powerful. And another form of disempowerment I see constantly is people who pretend the future is already decided rather than it's something we're making in the present by how we show up or how we fail to show up.
The thread there is participation, it seems to me, engagement. Yeah.
Participation and connection. You know, civil society is tremendously powerful when we come together, when we find those common denominators. And you see that that is actually quite threatening to authoritarians, elites, etc. Division, you know, divide and conquer is a catchphrase for a reason.
Are these things that give you hope? I mean, what personally gives you hope as you look out in the landscape and as you look for ways to engage and build community?
And so many things give me hope. I know how different the world is than the one I was born into. There was a time when people would be like, oh, feminism didn't change anything. And I'd be like, are you out of your mind? Do you have any idea what the status of women was before second wave feminism? Marriage was legally and culturally a relationship essentially of master and servant. Women had no bodily autonomy from their husbands. Marital rape wasn't a concept. Women were excluded and there were no laws to provide access from the Ivy Leagues, lots of other institutions of power, and just by convention from most positions of power. There were no women CEOs, almost no women in government at the higher levels, etc. And I was an adult when the first women joined the Supreme Court. So seeing that change gives me hope, seeing people continue to work for it, seeing the way that some of the burdens of prejudice around gender, sexual orientation, race, etc., that were so normal and even invisible when I was young, are not how most young people are now, seeing how successful the climate movement has been. And of course, that's about knowing we haven't done nearly enough, but we've done so much more than if we didn't show up. The solar revolution I find incredibly exciting. Solar is now the cheapest form of electricity in most of the world. The transition is obviously needs to be accelerated, but is well underway. And I've been hanging out with Julian Agwan, who's here in Hawaii part-time from Guam, who won this tremendous victory that didn't get enough attention in the International Court of Justice. 27 law students in the South Pacific decided, rather than to say, oh, we're powerless, oh, we're from tiny islands, oh, we're nobody, to do what they could, and ultimately they prevailed. The United Nations and then the International Court of Justice got on board with our idea that we need to hold nations accountable for their climate contributions in ways that we haven't before. It's maybe the biggest legal victory in the history of climate action. So things keep happening. Bad things too, and like we could go on about them all day, but those tend to get very well covered and very well remembered, and we have to pay attention to them. And if nobody did, I'd be here to talk about them. But
yeah, and it's about deciding where you're putting your energy and attention, right? That can, I think, decide in large part whether or not you're feeling hopeless or hopeful.
Exactly. And I think people lack the stories. There's a lot of reasons we are more submissive, manipulable, if we're isolated, if we're told these stories that we're basically selfish, that all we want is private pleasures and lots of toys. If we're told we want agency, belonging, meaning, hope for the future, justice, then we're demanding a lot more from institutions of power, and we're seeing that we're not just consumers, we're citizens. And I know we need a word that doesn't mean this is your national, you know, this is your legal status, but this is your presence in the community. You know, there are people who, in that sense, aren't citizens who are born here, and so many people who are immigrants and refugees who are valuable and active participants in civil society.
Yeah, participants, right? I think, too, you know, something you wrote many years ago, going back into the archive a little bit, that I felt always needed a little bit more attention is I feel like one way that political forces make people feel paralyzed, make people feel scared, make people feel like they have grievances to air, is spreading an idea of scarcity.
Yeah, I'm a little freaked out by that neoliberal take on abundance as just deregulation. There are some very good deregulations we could do, but you know, a lot of regulations are why your water isn't toxic, your rivers don't catch fire, your food isn't contaminated. But what we're told abundance is to have lots of money, lots of stuff. And I think there are other visions of abundance. Right now, most people don't have an abundance of time. They don't have an abundance of social connections. They don't have an abundance of confidence in the future. I think there's a lot of less material abundances that remind us that we have a lot of less material senses of scarcity. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough friends. I don't have enough time to make and maintain friendships. I don't have enough hope about the possibilities, you know. I don't have enough access to medical care or an affordable housing or, you know, a clean environment. I don't have confidence about the well-being of nature. And there's a lot of other ways to think about abundance than deregulation or piles of stuff.
Abundance, as you pointed out, is a word that we tend to get wrong here in a capitalistic society. The other one that I think sort of goes along with that is responsibility, right? We define responsibility in American terms by bootstraps and that kind of thing, right? But the different sense of responsibility we can have, right, to community, to others.
You know, the indigenous botanist Robin Wall Kimmerer talks about reciprocity with nature. And I found that such a wonderful shift. And responsibility always sounds to me like a parent saying, do your chores. It's your responsibility to vacuum and dust or, you know, whatever. You know, it's something you don't really want to do. You do grudgingly. Whereas reciprocity is like, I am so grateful for the wonderful things I've received and I want to give back. And so I think in, at least in relationship to nature, the natural world, the organic world, the world of the climate, a sense of reciprocity is really a sense that begins with gratitude, begins with another kind of abundance. We have received everything. Of course, we want to give back. And so those little reactions, I think, bring big changes in attitude and possibility.
That was Rebecca Solnit talking to HPR's D.W. Gibson. Solnit spoke at the University of Hawaii at Manoa last week as part of the Better Tomorrow speaker series. We will have a link to a recording of her talk on our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
This month, join us for discussions about culture and identity with two Kanaka Maoli authors. Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton presents Lurline Wailana McGregor, author of Between the Deep Blue Sea and Me, and Nikki Vandegar, author of The Invisible Wild. RSVP for these free events at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. And we now go to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to an endangered forest bird endemic to the island of Kauai.
Akikiki are small honey creepers with dark gray backs and light buff-colored undersides. Also known as the Kauai creeper, they're an endangered forest bird that's found only on the island of Kauai. If you're lucky enough to see an akikiki, it will probably be foraging for insects and spiders on the trunks and branches of a native ohia tree. It's become very hard to hear the song of the akikiki lately, but their more simple call can still be occasionally heard. Their population has been tragically decreasing, especially during the past 15 years, with numbers currently well below 500 birds. Akikiki are another example of the detrimental effects of climate change on a bird species. As temperatures continue to warm, disease-carrying mosquitoes are invading the last high-elevation strongholds for akikiki in the Alakai Plateau of Kauai, areas that were previously too cold for mosquitoes. The Kauai Forest Bird Recovery Project's working with other groups across the state to save these birds, but it will likely take landscape-scale eradication of mosquitoes to reverse their decline to extinction. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society. Since 1939, fostering community values that help to protect Hawaii's native birds through educational programs and scientific research. More at hiaudubon.org. Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing solutions to convert renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NereidHawaii.com.
Hawaii Public Radio brings the community together through our multi-platform Live from the Atherton event series. From jazz to classical, Hawaii Public Radio showcases local musicians in an intimate studio setting. We also welcome authors to host readings and discussions about their work.
This is a story, a mo'olelo. It's not really my story, but it involves me. Sometimes as a subject, sometimes as an unwitting object, sometimes as an unwilling participant. A mo'olelo that does not involve the teller is almost worthless. Just about as worthless as a story that is only about the teller.
Can't join us in person? Watch previous performances online on hawaiipublicradio.org/watch.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. We were already excited to come to Honolulu to do two shows at the Blaisdell Concert Hall, but now we're beside ourselves with excitement because on October 9th, we'll be joined by ukulele virtuoso Taimane, and on October 10th, we get to talk to Olympic gold medal surfer Carissa Moore. I just feel sorry for the people who have to decide which one to go to. For tickets, hey, maybe to both, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/waitwait.
Sponsored by Honolulu Financial Partners and Hawaii Pacific University.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Artist Esperanza Spalding blends jazz and other genres with storytelling, dance, and visual elements this Friday and Saturday in two sets nightly. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
University of Hawaii at Manoa is preparing to launch a new sustainable fisheries graduate program beginning fall of 2026. 8 new faculty hires will instruct the new program in Pacific fisheries, which will offer master's and doctoral degrees as well as online-only professional certificates. Kanoe Morishige is an assistant professor at the Center for Hawaiian Studies at UH Manoa and one of the new faculty hires for the fisheries program. She spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about why the new program couldn't have come at a better time.
Within this federal context and the threat that this administration poses to open up our marine national monuments to commercial fishing, both in Papahana Mokuakea and the Pacific Islands Heritage Marine National Monument, I think this program comes at a good time to really bridge the gap that exists between Western science institutions, so academic institutions, and local communities, especially indigenous communities, where now we have this opportunity to think more creatively, to invest in our communities of place, because the fight is only beginning to protect our ocean resources from industrial commercial fishing. And before I accepted this position, I was working for NOAA Papahanao Mokuakea National Marine Sanctuary, and I was a Native Hawaiian, I was managing the Native Hawaiian program. And through those experiences, I have deepened my understanding and my capacity to be an advocate along with our communities and my colleagues here at Kamakuakalani Center for Hawaiian Studies to advocate for the protection of places, special places like Papahana Mokuakea. And I think this is a reminder, and this is a time for us to gather, to rally, and to uplift Indigenous knowledge and relationships to our places as being that centerpiece for making decisions that will affect many generations in the future.
And you shared some of that perspective and some of these concerns at a recent Westpac meeting. What were you trying to get across to the people listening and to ultimately the decision makers?
Well, I gave an in-person testimony along with other colleagues here at Kamakuakalani and a bunch of other advocates for Papahana Mokuakea. And that public testimony, the purpose of it for me personally is to be on the record to show that there is Native Hawaiian opposition, Native Hawaiian and non-Native Hawaiian opposition to opening Papahana Mokuakea up to commercial fishing. And I really wanted to relay the message or to convey the message that Papahana Mokuakea is a sacred biocultural seascape to Kanako Iwi, to Native Hawaiians. And there have been 20 plus years of Native Hawaiian advocacy from our esteemed kupuna, like Uncle Buzzy Agard, Uncle Kavika Kapahulehua, Auntie Laura Thompson, and many others that were part of creating the foundations of protections that are worthy of a special place like Papahana Mokuakea. And it's important not to forget that history. What I really wanted to bring across is that we have a kuleana or responsibility as Kanako Iwi to continue that legacy of protections, to know that Papahanaumokuakea is a place for our ocean to be protected from industrial commercial fishing, to thrive, to regenerate, and to remind us for years to come what a healthy ocean looks like and what we should always be striving towards. And that doesn't mean excluding cultural practices. It actually is included in the way that Papahanaumokuakea is managed. There's a Native Hawaiian permit where cultural practices can continue within Papahanaumokuakea. So I wanted to bring that message to Westpac to show that, you know, I'm only one person out of generations of advocates for protecting Papahanaumokuakea. And there's no reason to open it to industrial commercial fishing, because that place is meant to function in its healthy state, both culturally, biologically, ecologically, and beyond. And if we don't protect it now, I feel strongly that we'll regret it in the future.
So these advanced degrees will be offered at UH starting the fall of 2026. Do you have an estimate of how many students you're hoping to have in this program?
Yes, it's supposed to be starting in fall 2026. We don't have an estimate of the number of students and professionals who would want to pursue degrees within this program, but we're hoping that we've been building interest in the program. There's been several conversations with partner organizations such as the State of Hawaii Division of Aquatic Resources and other NGOs to look at who within their agencies or their organizations might also be interested in receiving degrees or certificates from the program. So we're hoping that there'll be a lot of interest in people enrolling. But yeah, we're not too sure on the exact numbers right now, maybe 10 to 20, starting out at various levels, whether that's master's, the PhD. The professional masters will be all online, and the point of that was to make it accessible to professionals who are spread out across the Pacific Island region. And I think that's a really important part of trying to make these opportunities equitable for our communities and our professionals in places in the Pacific Islands other than Hawaii.
Is there anything else at this point that listeners should know as you ramp up to be able to accept the first students in about a year's time?
I think what I would want everyone to know is that this is a great opportunity to really change the paradigm of Western fisheries science. This program will look very differently compared to other fisheries programs in the Pacific Northwest, in Oregon and Washington. You know, here in the Pacific Islands, we have a very strong ocean culture, fisheries knowledge embedded within our indigenous Pacific Island communities, not only in Hawaii, but of course across Moana Nui Akea, our Pacific Islands. And I think this will be a huge opportunity to invest in our OEV, our Native Hawaiian, our Pacific Islander, and local students who are oftentimes marginalized because we face barriers in receiving advanced degrees in STEM and fisheries management. And I don't have the time to go into that, but I'm hoping that local people will be encouraged to see that they can be successful in programs like this, and that we are making a concerted effort to create jobs for our people, because being able to have local people, indigenous people within fisheries positions in research, whether that's research, management, or policy, is going to have a huge positive impact in maintaining our local expertise, maintaining really important relationships built over time with our local communities that you lose if you're just investing in people not from Hawaii who don't necessarily plan on staying here. And when they leave, you have to start again to build the relationship. So yeah, I'm hopeful that more local students will consider, local students and professionals will consider this program and be able to shape it in ways that I think go beyond what we envision for the program here and now.
That was University of Hawaii Professor Kanui Morishige, who will be teaching indigenous-led biocultural coastal management as part of a new degree program to be offered next fall. Look for links on our website later today. have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to keep an eye on the impacts due to the government shutdown. What's your experience? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our shows on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.